Hello and welcome to Mansplaining. I'm Stephen Kersner. Today we're going to talk about an issue that is crucial for men to talk about amongst each other and amongst mixed company, just to talk about it all. And that is the matter of depression. It's something which afflicts men far more than I think is reported. They say that the stats really are all over the place, but they all show that men have a huge problem with depression. Around 10% of Canadian men experience significant mental health challenges in their life. Approximately 1 million Canadian men suffer from major depression each year. On average, approximately 4,000 Canadians take their own life each year. And of those suicides, 75% are men. And let that sink in. And depression often manifests in ways that we aren't aware of. For example, migraines, back pain, irritable bowel syndrome, that can be rooted in depression. And some of the signs of depression, personality changes from the norm, mood swings, excessive anger, hostility, or violent behavior, the inability to cope with minor problems and daily activities. Those experiencing excessive anxieties or prolonged depressive states lose interest in hobbies or social activities that they were used to perk them up, increased use of alcohol or drugs, and noticeable difference in the ability to think clearly and articulate their thoughts in a cohesive manner. These are all things which our panel today have experienced, because I found it fascinating that when I put out the call to the people who are on our list for mansplaining, our list of people who I invite to participate every week. Not everybody participates every week, but I noticed that of the entire list, only one person said that they couldn't relate to this. Everybody else said that they either had been depressed or currently are depressed. And we don't want this to be a terrible downer of a show, and we're going to talk about ways to cope with depression, ways to come out of depression, rather than sitting here just commiserating. But it is important to commiserate. There's a stigma around depression, especially around men, not so much amongst women. Women are more socialized to go to their doctor when they feel something is amiss. Men are socialized to try to shrug it off. We talked about this last week in the show. So it's important that we have this discussion and reduce the stigma. With all of us sharing our experiences, we will hopefully make it clear to people that you can be men. You can be men of accomplishment. You can be men who have good lives and a good home life, good business life, and still be depressed. And it doesn't make you weak. It doesn't make you somebody who is unreliable. It makes you somebody who has an illness which can be temporary, and an illness which can be managed, but you first have to recognize that you've got it and not shame yourself for feeling that you've got it. These are all very important points, and we're going to talk about them today. The panel today include our newest member, Russell Connolly. Welcome, Russell.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Chris Hamilton, MC Illtones, welcome.
Hey, what's up, Stephen? How you doing, man?
Good to have you. We've also got Byron Rutledge. Byron, where are you pulled over today?
I'm in Langley today.
Langley? Okay, that's where you were last week.
Yeah.
Regular route?
No, I just got my truck out of the shop, and the shop's just down the block from the truck stop here, so it was just the closest place to park.
So no telephone poles in the back this week?
I'm currently empty right now, but I'll be loaded tomorrow morning.
All right. Of course, we've also got David Lisney with us from an hour outside of Edmonton. How's the weather there, David?
Frigid. Oh, actually, no, scratch that. A little less frigid. It was negative 20 overnight, and I think today's high is going to be a scorching negative 10, but still not warm enough in order to pump water to the barrel where the birds are. So I'm going to have to haul it from the bathtub and throw it in the back of the truck and drive it over a few times because birds need water.
So are you talking about chickens or bird bath?
Oh, well, I mean, it's definitely too cold for a bird bath. But no, like all of the birds need water. We just got one barrel and then we've got a couple of buckets where the birds actually drink from. But we have to like fill up that barrel rather than like trying to fill up water every single time. Basically, there is no water source at the bird houses. We have to like have a barrel there and fill up the barrel over and over again.
And you get to go out in that balmy minus 10 degrees. Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Paul Doroshenko is with us, the head of Acumen Law in Vancouver. Hello, Paul.
Hello. Nice to talk to everybody. I can tell you that the weather here is not the type of thing that would cheer you up today.
Well, it's interesting here where I am in Ontario. It's very, very sunny. So as long as you don't go outside, it's okay. As soon as you go outside, it grabs you. Aaron Seal from, you're still in Montreal, Aaron?
Still in Montreal. No reason to move. And it's a balmy minus 16 at the moment.
Oh, boy. That's winter, right? We're Canadians. We've been through it before. We'll be through it again. It's always difficult to figure out where to start with these things. Maybe I'll start by sharing my own experiences, maybe to make people more comfortable in sharing theirs. And this is something that is new for me, because for years, I would not let anybody know that I had depressive illness. I've had depressive illness since my teens. I didn't know what it was at first. I just recognized when I woke up in the morning, I felt really defeated and down, and just told myself, well, don't believe anything you think in the morning, and managed to get past it that way. And my desire to create, which gave me a boost, an endorphins boost, and my urgency in accomplishing things in my young life was me staying one step ahead of depression. Me always staying one step ahead by creating things. It was like I was building a bridge as I was walking across it. It got me more when I was in my 20s and when I realized that I had seasonal affective disorder, which eventually became just year-long battles with depression. And there have been some periods that have been dark. There was one five-year period. My wife will remembers it very well. And it wasn't terribly long ago, where I just was irritable. I was hell to live with. It was hard to live with myself, and just didn't feel, I kept trying things, but I think I couldn't give them that extra oomph that they needed to succeed. And I made decisions and got into business arrangements, trying to stay ahead of the depression that if I had been using proper critical thinking skills, I wouldn't have gotten myself involved in. And I hid the depression because when I was working at Much Music, I remember there being a meeting and there was a discussion of one of the staffers' complaints about something that was going on. And it was a very, very rational, reasonable, and supportable, like the evidence was there that this complaint was serious. And I recall one person saying, yeah, but he's got depression. He's just probably making a big deal out of nothing. And everyone sort of nodded and was like, oh yeah, you can't rely on his opinion. He's got depression. And at that point, I determined that there was no gain to be made in coming forward and admitting I had depression. I was on the company health plan. I did not include my depression medication in the company health plan receipts because I didn't want anybody seeing them and just determining they were going to write me off. I know that I'm not the only person who's been written off because they've admitted that they've had depression in the past. People, you know, if you disagree with them or you've got a bad feeling about something, they say, are you sure you're not just depressed? You know, they use it to minimize you and to delegitimize your concerns and delegitimize you as a person, as a reasonable, reasoning, thinking person. And it was only a couple of years ago at my wife's urging that I publicly admitted, yeah, I deal with depression and it sucks. And there's times that it overcomes me and I feel like there's no future, there's no hope. And even though my rational brain tells me one thing that is different than what my depressive brain tells me, the depressive brain is the one that really controls the emotions much more than the rational brain. So even though I can rationally look and see that what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling isn't rationally supported, it doesn't help to take away the depression. It's very difficult to reason your way through a depression. It's not impossible. I've done it on certain occasions, but people don't understand that depression isn't feeling sad. It's not, because sad is a normal feeling, a normal healthy feeling when in response to certain stimuli in life. We all have periods where we're sad and it's natural and it's okay. Depression is beyond that. It's feeling beyond sad when you don't really have the reason to, though eventually you may give yourself reasons to be sad because you sabotage yourself. That's sort of been my journey. And so I'm going to pass it over to you guys. We'll go one by one and share where you're coming from with depression. Again, the goal being that if we talk about the fact that we're all adults, we've all reached various levels of success in our life in various ways, in home or in work, in self-satisfaction, we've all faced this, because I think that the stats are very, very low. I think men don't report their depression as much as they actually feel it. And some might not even know that it's depression, because men are very good at covering depression with anger. And many men who have depression get sent to anger management instead of where they properly need to go. I'm going to start with David Lisney. David, why don't you tell us your experiences?
Yeah, you touched on so many important things, like the difference between things that cause you to be sad, things that cause you to be depressed, and having depression. For background-wise, looking back, I'd say in my 20s, I must have had depression. I never, never looked into getting professional intervention for it. But that description about rage, like in my teens, early 20s, looking back, I would have rage over things that would, looking back, really minor things. So it's possible. I don't feel as though I have depression now. So hopefully it was a short-term thing, but definitely throughout my life, there has been times that I've been depressed. I mean, most recently, I was telling the panel after the last podcast, my dog got run over on Boxing Day. And the hardest part about all that, well, there were many. One of them was the fact that he'd been good for months. Like, he's been let out hundreds of times. Just on his own, he would go on adventures. We have 17 acres. He'd be gone for a little while. We call him back and he'd come back hundreds of times before. The highway is right next to the property. There was basically no reason for it to happen. Basically no reason. And I won't get into the depth of it, but the fact that it was 100%, well, I'm presuming that it was unavoidable, that he was only 7 months old, an entire life ahead of him. That was such a jarring moment. And going through that, I definitely was depressed for a few days. Before that, the last time I had a moment that I felt depressed was the worst month in my life, still to this day, where my mother, my known grandfather, and my known grandmother, all three of them died in the same month. 1 month. And like that, you just feel like your floor beneath you, your very essence, your existence, everything that's going on in your life at that moment is gone. You feel like you're falling. You feel a pit of darkness. And that one took months to really move past from, to really cope with. And so, like I was saying, you touched on so many good points that there will be things that will happen in your life where you'll feel sad. It's short term. It's disappointment. It'll be things that are unforeseen, but your heart isn't torn into two, you know? Like, there'll be things that you're like, oh, this is a setback. And it'll kind of knock you down a little bit, but you put together a plan, you kind of move past it, you move forward. And then there will be bigger things where your heart just feels stretched possibly beyond compare for that moment, and that'll take a few days, a couple of months. It depends. But I think the biggest difference is from, and also all of these situations, you should seek intervention. When you're sad, just communicate with your support group. Anybody, just be like, hey, this sucks. You know, to just bounce it off other people and hear what other people have to say back again, because maybe you aren't just sad, it could be worse, or it's just the best way in order to kind of move past moments, to build on it, to gain strength from it. If something horrific happens to you, if it's relationships, people in your life, career, finances, anything jarring and anything that changes your life significantly, you may end up being depressed. And I'd say from my experience, from the takeaway that I had when I did seek professional help, was the biggest difference between depression and being depressed. Depression is ongoing. You feel like there is no hope, there is no future. Being depressed, having a moment of being depressed, it's like having cement shoes on. Everything is heavy. Everything is difficult. You don't feel like eating. You don't feel like doing your normal thing. Everything takes so much more energy in order to accomplish. But you do, and you keep trying, and you do what you need to do. You talk to who you need to, and you get past it. But that's a moment of being depressed, versus depression is just, it's something that you work with on an ongoing basis, and it may be your entire life. You may need in order to supplement your own body's ability in order to create certain chemicals. You may, and that's another huge stigma that society needs in order to move past. If your body is not capable of creating certain chemicals in order to make your brain function properly for you in order to function on a daily basis, there's nothing wrong with that. If you need in order to have those things in your life in order to make things possible, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with talking to everybody and anybody that you can about improving your life, about what's going on with your life. Like, yeah. Society in general, like, men should be allowed in order to talk to who they need to get professional help, to get whatever prescriptions are necessary, and to keep trying and to keep moving forward until you get in the right space.
Yeah, to your point, my depression is chemical. It's genetic. Mm-hmm. It's in my family. So as much as you feel like I hate having to take pills for this, thank God there are pills for this, is the other way to look at it. Thank you for sharing, David.
And thank you for sharing your story. That is so harsh that the place that you went to for work would already put a stigma on it, and then you're already struggling with that. I mean, yeah, thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome. Thank you for being receptive. Chris, why don't we talk to you?
Definitely something that I've struggled with as well. I grew up as a closeted bisexual in a small redneck town, and developed some pretty extreme social anxiety and depression issues as a result. Going back to what you said about, you know, some people get sent to a doctor to deal with their depression, but men usually are sent to anger management. That was exactly what ended up happening. I became a bit of a bully in high school. I myself became like an external homophobe, not that I was internally. The hate that I felt was towards myself and for the way that I was born. But I projected that onto others. I had disciplinary issues, fighting, drugs, all that sort of stuff cropped up for me in high school. And exactly like you said, I got sent to anger management. Eventually, I was diagnosed with bipolar. I took a host of different medications to try to deal with this, but none of them worked for me. And things became worse and worse, to the point that at one point in high school, I was expelled from school. I was kicked out of my home. I was living on a friend's floor. And, you know, I just buried all those issues with substance abuse. There's this social stigma against talking about these issues with friends and with men in general, you know. There are school counselors who are there to deal with this sort of stuff, and such resources exist, but it's not really too popular of an idea as a teenage dude to go, you know, to like a group therapy session to spill your feelings out to a group of other men.
No, it's intimidating.
It is, yeah, for sure. It's like we're, it's driven into us that men don't bear our feelings. We don't show our hearts on our sleeves, right? Or wear our hearts on our sleeves. It's actually seen as a point of pride for many men that they've never cried, or that they're not, that they don't discuss their feelings. You don't want to be the guy who will admit to being sad or depressed, right? It's seen as a sign of weakness, but for me, since that is the case nowadays, I see that as a point of strength. If I see a man cry in front of other men, or to honestly ask another man or anyone else for support or help with what they're dealing with. Nowadays, I deal I partake in Narcotics Anonymous. I'm just about 2 years clean from all my chemical dependency issues, and it's not uncommon for me to see a man cry in NA or AA meeting. And that's what the whole fellowship exists for, is it's a platform that we can go deal with our issues, our deep-seated issues, in a you know, I wouldn't say public, but a you know, more public way than just having them spinning around our minds all day until they finally just crush us as people and leave us feeling depressed. So I regularly talk about what's going on for me on the inside with groups of other men and women, and thus have no problem doing it today. But yeah, I wound up in drug and alcohol treatment by the age of 19 after a string of serious car wrecks and some half-hearted suicide attempts as well, which is something I don't talk about too often. But I've taken lots of pills to the point that I wound up in the hospital, and so on and so forth. And to me, that leads back to just having not been able to express myself. And eventually I just decided I was going to be honest with people. And I came out as a bisexual man to my friends and family, and later to the whole music industry of which I'm a part of. And it was a step-by-step process, and I thought I'd be judged. And what that came back to is the judgment I felt towards myself. And yeah, it's nowadays I feel a lot better walking through life, honestly being able to deal with my stuff rather than putting on that false face and pretending everything's okay. I'm not always okay, and I'm not afraid to say that. Not every day is perfect when you have bipolar disorder. So yeah, I've dealt with some pretty major depression. I mean, I lived over in the Lower Mainland for a long time, and my chemical dependency issues after a relapse in my 20s led me to the downtown east side. And I was able to observe other people down there too. Like, Vancouver's downtown east side is one of the most condensed ghettos in North America. And I was able to, you know, converse with some of the people down there and learn from some of the support workers who work down there in the hood, and kind of learned that a lot of these people's issues stem from mental health. You know, you might just think, oh, these lazy dudes just don't want to get a job, but a lot of them have severe schizophrenia, and they don't even have the wherewithal to access the support outlets that are there to be accessed for such people. So not always their fault, you know what I mean? And a lot of it stems back to mental health. So now at just about 2 years clean, I make sure that when something crops up for me mentally, I deal with it in a constructive way rather than letting it fester. I have a sponsor. I have a home group of Narcotics Anonymous. I have a lot of friends in recovery who are totally cool with a dude venting his feelings to them. And I make sure that I don't let things sit for too long.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that. Byron? Byron?
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. First, thank you all for sharing. I really appreciate hearing your stories. For me, my depression is rooted in my ADHD and RSD, rejection sensitivity dysphoria. Basically, I can find rejection in anything, and depression can hit me out of the blue like a freaking sledgehammer to the side of the head for no reason and disappear just as quickly. Most days I have to force myself to get out of bed to go to work. It's always been tough for me to talk about it. This is the first time I've really talked about it other than with my wife. So.
Well, we appreciate you doing that. Yeah, it's,
but I can relate with everybody's stories, like the, not so much the drug abuse myself, but just with the struggle of not being able to open up and having to just fight to even do the most basic mundane activities.
That is interesting. That is part of it, isn't it? It's just it's amazing how simple little things around the house, things which really normally you wouldn't even think twice about, feel like you're moving through molasses trying to do that, because for some reason you've got a bad feeling about doing it, even though you know logically there's no reason to have anxiety about it. There's no reason for it to make you sad, but something triggers in your head and it associates with that particular task or activity, and suddenly it just becomes very difficult, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Like the one thing about my job is it's extremely isolating. I mean, I spend 325 days a year in a truck by myself. And honestly, though, the pandemic has kind of been a blessing in disguise, because now I don't have to make an excuse to not go and do something with a friend. Mm-hmm. It's kind of sad hearing myself saying that, but now it's not, oh, I'm busy or I got to take care of this when I'm not working. It's sorry, it's pandemic. I can't come out. You know, like it's kind of just like a built-in excuse now. And it's the more time I spend at work, the harder it is to go back to the real world every time I go home.
I can imagine that. That's hard for us to relate to such a solo enterprise that takes you, you know, most of the year, finds you alone. That's hard to relate to, but certainly isolation, as we found during COVID, isolation has led to quite a bit of mental health problems. So I guess you were sort of a pioneer in that.
Yeah, well, I mean, also living in tiny homes before it's cool. We, you know, I did that too, I guess. But yeah, I didn't have to adjust to the whole social distancing thing, because I've been doing it for so long. It's just kind of my life really didn't change all that much, other than the excuse I used to not go and see people.
All right. Thank you for sharing, Byron. How about you, Russell?
Yeah, I have to say, you guys kind of nailed it pretty close to how I was feeling with all of it. I mean, the one thing when I went to talk to my doctor, which, I mean, in Canada, you know, it's provided to us through the government, so if you can, go talk to your doctor. But he said to me, you know, tell me if this is how you feel. And he said, do you feel like you're a car on blocks and someone has their foot on the gas and you can't get that release? And that completely nailed how I was feeling. And, you know, we then, you know, worked on finding a medication that works for me, and, you know, things have worked out since then. I mean, you have your highs and lows, but that's also how life is. It's not just going to be a high. So you have to learn to handle it when it gets bad, find things that, you know, fix your mood. And I think one thing that I've, obviously with COVID, you know, everyone's at home alone. I did a lot of reading last year. I read about 45 books.
Oh my.
And some of them, I actually learned a lot from. One of them was written by, I believe she's a Canadian journalist. The title is not the kind of book you want to read in public, but it's called Hello, I Want to Die, Please Fix Me. And it's very, very, very upfront story of her depression, and then a little bit of history about how medications work. And, you know, just kind of hearing somebody else's story really helped for me, because I find if I, you know, read a theoretical story where it's not, you know, someone saying I did this, I find I don't take that info. But to hear someone say, you know, when I get really down, these are things that help for me, and you may find that could actually work for me, and you try it and you find your ways of dealing with it when it gets bad.
That's thank you for sharing the name of that book. It's important to find these things. I find sometimes I can't read those books when I'm depressed because I'm afraid it'll make me more depressed. But in fact, they often are a bit of a tonic when you recognize, hey, you're not alone out there. There's a lot of people feeling what you're feeling. And that part of your rational brain that is struggling to tell you that this is not rational, it gets a boost from these readings. So thank you for sharing that and sharing your experience. I know this is it's your first show. It's a hell of a first show to be part of. Usually we're kidding around a lot. Yeah. but there's times for levity and times where it's important to be serious. So thank you very much for that. I want to go to Paul Doroshenko. Paul, your feelings. How are you feeling now?
Well, I'm really depressed right now, and I've been really depressed for a few years off and on, but it's been very bad in the last little while. I recognize that I was like a melancholy kid when I was about 9 or 10 years old. I had an uncle who committed suicide, and that was sort of quite a turning point for me, but I was always a bit of a loner, and that may have been part of the issue, but I don't know if it was a result of the depression or if it was what it was. My dad always thought that I was just very introspective and thoughtful and thinking about my situation. I don't really know that that was the case, but by the time I was in grade 9, I was treated for depression. So I was given some sort of medication. I didn't take it regularly, so it didn't affect me well. That was sort of it. My parents broke up at that point. Their marriage came apart, and I was institutionalized for a week because they were concerned about my mental health. Ultimately, the people in the hospital, said that I was a well-balanced kid and that I just was dealing with it as best I could. But I've suffered with it off and on to some extent or the other, basically my entire life. And there's been periods, when I had my children, for example, I went through a period where I wasn't depressed from like 2009 to 2015. But then, things come back and it's a real struggle. And in those periods that I wasn't depressed, I have difficulty sympathizing with people who are. And the periods that I am, I'm particularly empathetic, as you can imagine. And it's been, I'll tell you right now, I've never been really public about it. My colleague Kyla came out about her eating disorder a few years ago and has encouraged me to not hide my aspect of my depression. So I've decided not to, but it's a dangerous thing. As a lawyer, I can tell you, when I applied to the Law Society of BC, they asked me, questions they ask you about are your mental health, and it's really stigmatizing. And I had gone through a period where I was in pretty good shape because I just finished law school. I was feeling, I could see the end light at the end of the tunnel. So I just checked off, no problem. And I didn't want them to, I didn't think it was any of their goddamn business. But I've had articled students since who, when they've admitted, that they've suffered depression or whatever, then they question whether or not they should ever be lawyers. And then they've got to monitor their, we have to monitor their mental health during their articling period. You know, we do that in any event because students tend to get depressed just generally, but the difficulty is right now in the pandemic, obviously it's made it worse, not just for the, the concern of survival, which many men have, and the concern of the humiliation of the struggle and facing the difficulty of trying to, maintain your life for your family and so forth. For me, I do feel slightly relieved from the social obligations, which is useful, but all of the other obligations that arise have been a real problem. As I age, I'm 52 now, right? So I've known that I was depressed for over 40 years. And so I can recognize when it's coming on. When I, in 2015, It was clear I was going to have to start taking care of my dad. And that was sort of a trigger for it. I hit my head. I had a concussion in 2016, which didn't help. Donald Trump getting elected was just a, you know, made me think that the world was collapsing. And I knew that eventually his reign of terror would end. But it was miserable to see everything that you could predict unfolding. I came very close to being a Holocaust historian instead of a lawyer. And one of the things that I did when I studied Germany in the 1930s and 40s was think about 1920s to the end of the war, was to think about the things that took place that so you could recognize it when it happened again. And, you know, recognizing to see that it happening again was very, very frustrating. I have my methods of dealing with it. When I was in my, about 20 years ago, I went to the doctor, not because of depression, but because of social anxiety. I found as a lawyer, I needed to be more gregarious. I can be when necessary, but often it's very difficult. And he put me on a low dose of Paxil, and I've been on it ever since. And it keeps me from the worst of the worst, but it certainly doesn't eliminate the depression. And of course there's side effects to it as well that have, that are, you know, somewhat miserable. But part of my depression, I recognize, is my desire to do everything correctly at all times. My desire for perfection in, you know, many things. And that's not necessarily useful. I used to find I like to do a lot of manual labor things, construction, auto mechanics, woodwork, and all of those things engaged me and made me satisfied in the product of my work and made me feel like I was doing something, but they never engaged my mind enough to stop it from racing ahead and taking me to that really dark place. It's a frustrating thing, but I feel that I'm condemned to this to the rest of my life, and you know, I'll just do my best.
It's interesting that you point out that they asked the question about your mental health so that you have a choice. I mean, you at the time felt that your mental health was okay, so you had no problem checking off that your mental health was okay. But faced with the same thing, I would have just lied and said that my mental health is fine, knowing that if I checked the box otherwise, there would be consequences. And so they make you, things like that make you hide your mental illness, which makes you ashamed of your mental illness.
It put me in a tough spot.
Yeah. And it creates feelings of shame, feelings that you're a liar. Those kinds of questions shouldn't really be asked anymore, except in maybe cases like police officers or where you're carrying a weapon, something of that nature, because it does stigmatize it.
Because, you know, my dentist, when I told my dentist that I was on this low dose of Paxil, when I, you know, wanted to know what medication I was on, he told me basically everybody is on something. It's a huge portion of the population, lawyers, judges, doctors. And I've had doctors with depression and a doctor who quit practicing because he was depressed. I mean, the reality is that a huge portion of the population experiences this, and you're thrust in that position that you just said, where I have to lie. You know, I wasn't clinically diagnosed at the time. I knew that I was suffering depression when I was in university. I was profoundly depressed. And it was only the last few months when I was filling out that form that I was like, well, I'm not depressed right now. So I'm not fucking telling you anything else about it, because really this is, you know, the stigma of it is miserable. And I'm very happy to see the change in society that's now allowing us to talk about this. But I'll tell you, it was really not there for me for much of the time that I've really needed it. I do appreciate the change a great deal. I've had my methods of dealing with it. Some things have worked and some haven't. It certainly hasn't worked to alleviate my depression, but I have managed to avoid any attempts at suicide.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I've never actually considered how to kill myself, but there are times that I felt jealous of dead people because they didn't have to deal with this shit anymore. And, you know, times where you think, well, if I close my eyes and I don't wake up, that wouldn't be the worst thing. That's not the same thing as wanting to cause that to happen, but it's still a sickness. It's still something that, needs to be addressed. And I'll tell you, depression is also hell on those around you.
The problem is that it is a natural state, right? Like if this many people experience it, it is a natural state of human behavior. And if you go over 200,000 years of human history, pretty good chance I would not have survived to the age of 52 to be this depressed. You know, I would have died in a war, a battle, an illness or something. But the fact that I get to live with this thing for my basically entire existence, I suppose, like, I know I can write good poetry. It's not really what I want. I would rather not.
Yeah. Well, okay. You found a silver lining.
Somewhat.
Well, thank you for sharing all that, Paul. I know this stuff isn't easy. And now we'll go to Aaron Seal, who I know has a story for us. Aaron?
Yeah, I should probably precede this with a bit of a trigger warning because I'll get into my diagnosis, and I'll acknowledge this as a diagnosis, is treatment-resistant depression. And treatment-resistant or refractory depression means resistant to both, I don't remember if it's one or three courses of medication plus psychotherapy. I was first diagnosed with depression in 2006. I lived and worked with it for a decade. And I say that with an intent to sort of normalize those years. I was on medication through all those years. I worked as an advisor on Parliament Hill. Anybody who thinks I did good work at that time, it's not everybody, but anybody who thinks my work was good, that work was done by a depressed man on medication. So there should be no shame in it. But unfortunately, the void deepened. There were two major crashes. The first one in 2015, which turned out to be a precursor to the bigger one in 2016, which left me on medical disability. And without getting into too much unnecessary detail, I have multiple hospitalizations for self-harm on my record. I did my best to internalize the misery, but that happened. Those were the bad years. And I hope nobody listening ever gets to that point. And my first thought to anybody listening is, if you need help, seek it and seek it with urgency. Demand it if you need it. Don't let yourself get to that point. Don't let others around you be exposed to what you could become if you get to that point. Seek help and seek it early. The flip side of that coin is, make sure the help actually helps. Some people come out of major depression evangelical about mental health care. I'm not one of those people. I've seen the system at its best, and I will specifically cite Markham Stauffville Hospital. There are people within that institution working together who did keep me alive, who genuinely cared and invested emotionally. And anything I am or become, I owe to them. I've also seen the worst, and literally on the CSPO, the Ontario Medical Regulatory Body's website, you'll see there's one doctor who was sanctioned for negligence as a result of my case. And that's the most extreme example. And I say it to illustrate that I've lived both sides. So like I say, there's no shame in seeking quality help. And if you need it, please do seek it with urgency. But not all help is created equal. So make sure the help actually helps.
Thank you for sharing that. And you're right that not all help helps, and not everybody can be helped by what, you know, something like medication or psychotherapy. I think it's a crime that psychiatry is covered by health plans, at least in Ontario, I know, but there's not enough psychiatrists, and psychotherapy is not covered. And some people don't need psychiatry. Some people don't need the medical component. Some people need psychotherapy. Even some people who need psychiatry can be helped by psychotherapy, but psychotherapy is not covered by health plans. And we've got, as Paul pointed out, that he learned that this is a natural condition. There's so many people experiencing this that it rises to the level of a common concern. And yet we don't have the means you know, the financial means with which to go and deal with this health problem. The only thing we can get is medication. And sometimes psychotherapy can help where medication can't, and or it can help with medication, but on it, medication on its own doesn't do enough. And it's a real weakness in the system, because God knows how much productivity, if you want to boil it down to the economy, how much productivity we lose every year because of depression. Because they say, you know, well, we can't afford to include psychotherapy in government health plans. Well, how can we afford the loss of all that productivity caused by depression? If there was a way to find a way to aggregate that amount of money and figure out exactly how much roughly we're losing every year to lack of productivity due to depression, I think it would probably exceed the cost of providing psychotherapy to those who need it. What I want to talk about now is methods to get out of depression or to manage it when you're in it. Not always possible when you're in the deepest of it, but there are, I think probably all of us have little things that we've done to try to help ourselves get out of depression, little things that even if they work very briefly, they do something. I know that, as I mentioned in my case, being creative and creating things does help help me with my depression. It, sometimes I'll draw also. Sometimes I'll make things out of Sculpey, which I've been doing since I was a little kid. I'll just, the act of creating tends to focus me. The act of watching television. Television has always been one of my, it was my first love. And so watching television shows, especially ones that are not particularly challenging, sometimes the ones that are the most predictable, there's a comfort to it. It's almost like comfort food. That works for me. And I've also, I mean, I look around my house, my wife and I have a huge collection of superhero toys and art. And I looked at it recently and realized that all of that was me fighting depression, because looking at that stuff makes me smile. And so this massive collection that I've got, including toys from when I was a child that either got lost or thrown out somehow by my parents that I refound on eBay. Looking at these things gives me a boost. It's kind of like recharging my batteries. But then I looked at how much of the stuff I have, and I realized so much of that stuff was me coping with depression. And now I look at it and say, do I really need all of this stuff? And what do I do with it all? But there's, you know, I'm looking right now at just a collection in one little area in my office where there's a bunch of toys from my youth. And I look at it and it immediately lifts my spirits. And so I guess the thing there is to find the line between collecting things for that reason and hoarding in ways of just trying to avoid dealing with the problem. Because one of the greatest fears of my people, at least I can speak for myself, one of the greatest fears of depression is when you've come out of it, one of the greatest fears is going back into it, is the thought of having to, of going back into it. So I will do things to try to ward off depression, which in the end doesn't wind up being, they don't wind up being the wisest choices I made. It's, but, and that's not a way to get out of depression. That's just another symptom of depression. But I find that creating things and spending time with my wife, spending time with our cats, less so my dog because he's dumb, recharging myself with things that brought me happiness from my youth, those are things that can help me cope when I'm having difficulty coping. What about you, Russell? What helps you?
You know, I mean, I think I would just talk right now, sort of during COVID. I mentioned, you know, I read a lot of books.
Yeah.
And the one thing I find is to have, like, they're not eBooks. I actually buy the physical book because I find it helps to have, you know, something that you can actually hold focus on.
It's a very different experience. You
know, yes. I also played a lot of video games. Newer stuff. I wasn't really much of a gamer before, but I mean, obviously you have all this time at home, so you need something to keep you occupied. And the other one that I can't describe why it, you know, relaxes me, but just going for a long walk and, you know, taking pictures of, you know, nice houses, nature, or when it was allowed, renting a car, going to like some of the more rural parts of the province and just, you know, taking pictures of what you see. And I've framed a bunch of them and I have them hanging up all over my place as something to look at.
You know, the taking a walk is actually something that my doctors have recommended too. And apparently it has great curative effect. I don't do it as much as they tell me I should. But it's not unusual that walking and seeing the world through the camera lens, I can see how that can be therapeutic too. So thank you for sharing that, Russell. How about you, Chris? Go on.
Oh, I was going to say going to the gym, but that's, so this is kind of my substitute for going to the gym right now until that's.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up gym because exercise is apparently a huge way to combat depression. And I should exercise more. I've got the means to do so in the house. I've got an exercise bike. I've got a rowing machine. And if my wife didn't use the exercise bike, it would sit there. And that's just something I'm going to have to get my ass in gear over. How about you, Chris?
Yeah, exercise is a big one. So I also, in addition to having been diagnosed with bipolar, I also have been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactive disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And with ADHD as well, I actually heard this from a, I don't know what his exact title was, but he was like a sports therapist or like some dude like that who used sports and exercise as therapy for dealing with such issues. I can't break down the science behind what he said because I probably wasn't paying close enough attention during it. But he did highlight the fact that like getting out in the morning and getting those endorphins pumping is a keystone way of dealing with something like ADHD. Also just not sitting in isolation for too long. Like I too like to shut my mind off sometimes with like an old, you know, comedic television show that I love, like Seinfeld is a good one for me. It doesn't matter how many times I see those episodes.
Right.
I still love them and I gain like this sense of security knowing that this is something that I connected with in my childhood that I still love today. But just not doing it for too long. Like it's easy to binge on Netflix or whatever you're going to do, but getting out and engaging in the community and speaking with others and knowing that we're not alone. And that's why for me, my fellowship programs are so paramount just because, you know, I gain the validation that I'm not the only one struggling with these issues. There's also a lot of like positive podcasts like this around too. Some that are dealing specifically with mental health as well that, you know, can be tuned into. I've actually appeared as a guest on many of those as well. And yeah, just, you know, gaining the validation that we're not alone because you never are. You're never alone in dealing with what you're dealing with. There are millions of others who feel the same way. So we shouldn't have to sit with ourselves and deal with our issues spinning around in our minds. We can get them out in the open and figure out pretty quick that there are outlets to help us out with them.
Thank you very much, Chris. David?
Yeah, all those are excellent points. In my experience, when there's something that happens to you and you become and you end up in a depressed state, the first step is communication immediately after getting back into a routine. It's really easy in order to lose track of the simplest things like eating, drinking, sleeping, and to just really work on the little accomplishments along the way. Having three meals a day, just three, no more, no less. If you have less, it's out of a routine. If you have more, then you're fixating and you're not overcoming anything. Three meals a day, reasonable meals, and do it until you're full. And I stress all of these points because personally, I've had times where food becomes a crutch. Like a lot of people have been mentioning about drugs, alcohol, other substance abuse. Overeating is still, it can still become addictive. It can still become something that you fixate on, and that becomes a numbing agent. And that the third kind of thing in order to keep in mind, if you're in a depressed state, you have to feel. You have to feel just enough so that you can reach out, you can get help, but that you don't fall back on things that numb that feeling, that everything that you're doing in order to get into a better state of mind and a better place is constructive, not numbing, that you know exactly how you feel, why you feel it, and you're making efforts in order to move forward so that you're in a better place, you're in a constructive place, you're in the right mindset in order to get back into as close of a normal life as you can get. And any numbing agent, anything that your brain turns off when you're in that mindset and when you're indulging whatever that obsession is, it could even be binging like a TV show. You know, if it's getting to the point where you're having something in excess, then you have to take another step back. You have to recognize that you still need to feel, because unfortunately, a majority of the time when you're in a depressed state or even sad, you have to feel to have that opportunity in order to overcome it. You have to feel in order to know that what you're doing is not productive, it's not going to help you get into that state. And more importantly, if you are finally seeking professional help, if you're already in the state of numbing, then you're not going to necessarily get the right feedback in order to get to where you should be. And that's the final point. You may even forget what normalcy was. You may never have had normalcy in your life. You may have never had a moment where you're kind of looking at it like, you know, things are good. Life is great. Things are exactly where I want it to be. You may not have something like that to reflect back on, but it is possible. I know, even on this panel, there are instances where it may be a lifetime challenge, but for anybody who's in that moment that is like, everything is so heavy, just keep on trying, keep on moving, keep on getting that help, keep on finding out different ways, keep on finding new sources. The most recent, just like a month ago now, where I was just so heavy and it felt so bad, I started looking into, specifically Sad Guru. He has a lot of videos that, strangely enough, came up on Facebook just when I needed to, about kind of spirituality and looking at the greater things. And the thing is, that worked for me. It may not work for everybody, but spirituality is a great way in order to try and find a meaning when you feel as though there is no meaning, there is no point, there is no purpose. But just keep on moving forward, keep on looking for whatever source there is in order to get you to a place where you deserve to be, even if you haven't felt that way in the past.
Thank you. Those are really, really good points, David. Very well thought out. Thank you for sharing all of that. Byron, how about you? What are some steps you take to help yourself cope or to climb out of the worst of it?
I definitely go to food as a numbing agent at times.
Right.
I think that would be my drug of choice. But I try and take a step back and kind of focus on this stuff that I can see immediately that is going okay for me. And kind of actively talk my brain out of screaming at me. Worst come to worst, I'll throw on a TV show I don't have to think about to watch, or I'll pick up my guitar, or when I'm home, I'll play Lego with the kids and whatnot. And that kind of stuff just kind of helps me get through it, I guess.
Good steps. Good steps. It's good that everybody has their own, and you know, everybody may have their own way, but whatever steps you can take that work, those are great steps. Paul, how about you?
I've had lots of methods over the years to deal with it, depending on how bad it was. When I was in university, I used to go to the gym 2 days a week, and that sort of kept me floating above water. Sometimes when I lived alone, I would I'd either go for a drive or I would go somewhere where there was people, even if I wasn't talking to anybody, even just walking around the mall. Retail therapy can mean buying something or can mean just being around other people. That was somewhat useful for me. I used to buy myself a shirt once a month when I was in university, and I kept all of my clothing in pristine condition, and it sort of made me feel slightly better. I've learned in the last few years, and there was a scientific study to back it, that Tylenol can help you if you are grieving in bereavement. And strangely, I found sometimes, you know, if I take a Tylenol, it just takes away some of the pain of existing. And can assist me. Otherwise, I think it through. And I mean, thinking it through never gets me out of my depression, but it can sometimes provide me with perspective. Again, you know, I was a historian, and I think about the misery that many people have lived through in their lives, and sort of what my ancestors had to go through in order to for me to exist. And I feel a debt to them and a debt to my children. And that debt is, you know, keeps me going on the treadmill. It gets me out of bed every day knowing that I've got to fulfill that debt to those people who came before me and those people who I created. That's not a very happy way to look at it, but it does keep me moving. And again, routine, you know, is keeping moving, right? If you have something to do, routine is very helpful in alleviating depression. When I was in my worst in university, and I would not have a routine when the term changed, and I would not have a motivation to get up right away because I didn't have a class until 11 o'clock. I found that's when I was sort of sinking into the worst of it. And, I just discovered the value of routine. So it does assist me, but none of these things really, you know, like I last summer I started riding my bike. It did assist me. It doesn't really alleviate it to the extent that I would like or eliminate it. That's for sure. I can say the only time that there was a prolonged period where I did not feel depression was after my kids were born, and that's certainly not a way of dealing with it, or you know, looking at for a solution. However, one can understand why people would want to have a lot of kids, because each time my child was born, I spent like 2 years where I was not depressed at all. and after the birth of each child, I just was so engaged in it and so excited about their existence, and just I couldn't be depressed, and it was lovely. But it was the only time I've really experienced a prolonged period of not being depressed.
That might explain why I have so many cats.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Similar idea. Okay, and finally, Aaron, what steps? Because you're resistant to therapy and to medication. So what steps have you taken that have been successful or partially successful to help you cope?
Well, the one thing I want to say at the outset is depression is not stupidity. And I say that for a reason, because patients need to navigate the system. If you are at the point where you feel you are in need of help, and you are seeking and demanding help, you need to remain informed about the types of help that should be available and the differences between them. Because, and I can say this from firsthand experience, if you get bad help or if you get the wrong help, it can make you worse rather than better. At my pivot point, as I was sort of at the worst of it and scratching and clawing towards better, I started doing a lot of reading. Like Russell gave a book reference earlier, I can give another. It's a book called Lost Connections, which came out almost at the worst of my depression. I think it was in 2018. And it was very timely because it spoke in my voice. And around the same time, I reached out to a professor of psychology at the University of Colorado, Dr. Jonathan Shedler. He was very kind. He gave me an hour of his time. And the reason why he was important to me is because he's a contrarian in therapeutic methods. And I'll phrase it as CBT versus Freud, cognitive behavior therapy versus Freudian psychotherapy. Cognitive behavioral therapy is the dominant paradigm right now. And in a lot of places within public mental health care, and even within private care, that's all you can get. It was never going to work for me. So Dr. Shedler was very kind with his time, generous, pointed me in the right direction in Toronto. But I had to navigate the system, both in terms of therapeutic methods and just to find this stuff because the mainstream didn't offer it. So like I said at the outset, if you are in need of help, I've been hospitalized. I've seen all kinds of patients. I'll tell a story from my first hospitalization. A wise old man, I'll call him, looked me in the eye and said, there's three types of people here. There are people who are trying to recover from addiction. They're in pain. There are people with an emotional problem that they have to deal with And there are people who are past the point of no return, either because of physical mental disintegration or some sort of psychosis. I've seen that latter group and it's not pretty, but if you're just depressed, you can still take control of your place in the system and you can still advocate for the quality of your care. So I recommend that you do so.
Okay. Thank you very much for that, Aaron. That's good advice. Okay, well, this has been a heavy one, but a useful one. I want to thank all of you for sharing your experiences and your methods of coping. It's, again, all designed to try to take down the stigma that we've all felt at times and perhaps still feel around this. People listening have heard men from various walks of life and various economic and professional backgrounds with one thing in common, depression. And it's much more common than people think. I think you'll find if you confide in somebody, they'll confide in you that they've felt it themselves as well. So let's all do our best to be as empathetic to others as possible and to be as brave as we can be in being honest about the state of our mental health. It's difficult to reach out to people. It's difficult to ask for help, but it's worth it in the end. People are there to help you, and you'd be surprised how many people are there to help you, not judge you, but help you. So I want to thank everyone for participating today. Chris Hamilton, thank you.
No worries, always a pleasure. This was a great episode with some solid input.
Thank you. David Lisney, thank you.
Yes, this was an important topic and I'm very grateful for being part of it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Byron Rutledge, thanks again.
I appreciate you having me. It was good to talk about it. I appreciate everybody's input today.
Paul Doroshenko, thank you and wishing you the best.
Thank you very much and thanks to everybody.
Aaron Seal, thank you for sharing what was, I know, a very, very long and difficult time in your life.
Thank you for inviting me, Stephen. And like I say, if you are in need of help, please seek it with urgency. Don't delay.
Thank you. And Russell Connolly, thank you for your first episode. It was a great job. They're not all this heavy. We'll do one next week that's a lot of fun, and you'll be part of the fun ones as well. But thank you for joining us. We're always glad to have new voices and new experiences to share with us here. So I appreciate that very much.
Yes, thank you for having me. And I guess thank you to Hafiz, because I messaged him after one of the episodes to say, I really enjoyed it. And he put me in touch with everybody.
And that brings up that for those noticing that Hafiz hasn't been here, Hafiz, his business has really picked up. He's got a big contract that he's working on. And that has meant that he hasn't had the time to put towards podcasting, and he won't for a few months. We will hear from him again. But in the meantime, we wish him well with the enterprise that he's engaged in right now. And while we miss him, we will soldier on, and we'll wait to hear him again. I want to thank everybody for participating, and I hope those of you listening got a little bit of help or a little bit of solace or a little bit of comfort out of what we talked about today. I'm Stephen Kersner. This has been Mensplaining on the Fun Network. For he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow.